Concerned about microplastics? Well, how much plastic are you wearing right now? And how would you even know? And what can we do to build more sustainable clothing and limit things like microplastics in our air, in our water, in our food, and ultimately in ourselves? I'm Lee Rayburn, and our first guest today is Jessica Frantel. She's an assistant professor in the fashion department at Mount Mary University. And if you have a question about plastics in fashion or microplastics and how they go from our clothes into inside us, you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. If you have a story to share about how you keep your clothing sustainable, how you reuse clothing and limit microplastics, please, you can also send us an email, talk@wpr.org. And Jessica, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jeff.
So let's start with this. How would I know whether or not I'm wearing plastics? Where do we find plastics in fashion today?
Well, unfortunately, basically everywhere. I think the easiest way to find it in your own closet is, of course, checking the tag, right? Finding out what the fiber content of your clothing is, seeing if it's synthetics or natural fibers is kind of the quickest way to determine if what you already have or what you're purchasing would have any plastics in it.
So what are the natural fibers I would be looking for sustainable fashion?
Sure. So ideally, anything like cotton, linen, wool, silk, anything along those lines are naturally occurring products, and therefore they are going to be biodegradable. There are some synthetics that are made of biodegradable things, but then how they're treated makes them less so. But yeah, natural fibers is the way to go.
Is it me, or are these natural fibers more expensive than the ones that are unnatural?
Absolutely. And I mean, that's actually even in the 1800s, 1900s, when a lot of these synthetics were first developed, that's what they were made for. So they were supposed to be recreating the characteristics of natural fibers in a way that was easier to work with, less expensive, things like that. So yeah, they are definitely going to be a little more expensive. But by the flip side of that, it can be more of an investment purchase. So they're also, if taken care of properly, going to last you longer and, you know, have a better sort of life cycle as a garment. So there are trade-offs there.
So natural fibers would be more along the lines of slower fashion as opposed to the plastic fibers, which you would consider probably more likely to be fast fashion, as they say?
Yeah, I think I would say fast fashion is probably going more towards synthetics. I think it's hard, though, because we see a lot of what's called sort of greenwashing of fashion, right? So we see lots of fast fashion companies that are saying, oh, this is all organic cotton or things like that, but not really addressing where it's shipped from, what it's packaged in, what sort of the entire life cycle of the product is. So once you dig into it, it gets a little more complicated than that, unfortunately.
So if you're concerned about plastics, I think when you start thinking about fashion, it becomes a real uphill battle quite quickly. So what, in your role as assistant professor in the fashion department at Mount Mary University, where do you start with your students when it comes to solutions?
Sure. So I think we start with information. So Mount Mary we were actually the first four-year fashion program in the country. So we have a long history of really seeking to educate our students, most of whom end up going out into the industry. And I think with any industry, it's the new, younger employees, the people who are coming into it with newer learning, who are really instigating change. So we like to really equip our students to do that. So first, it's exposing them to the issue. A lot of people don't necessarily know how much of an issue fashion is, how much it is lending itself to pollution and environmental waste and microplastics. So the focus of the grant I've been working on with Wisconsin Sea Grant has really been educating our students in the issues surrounding microplastics, so that then they can start kind of integrating that into their own design work and then hopefully taking that into the field after they graduate.
Can you talk a little bit more about this grant from Wisconsin Sea Grant and the role that they are playing in this program?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been working with an amazing team of women from Wisconsin Sea Grant, Milwaukee River Keeper, and Plastic Free MKE. They actually approached me. They were interested in doing a grant through NOAA, exploring ways to educate fashion students about the issue of microplastics. And being in the Milwaukee area, in the sort of Milwaukee watershed, made Mount Mary really perfectly placed for that. So we've been working on it for 2 years now, where we have been presenting information to the students. We've been funding the purchase of natural fiber fabrics for students to use. We've been doing workshops and hosting stuff swaps, doing upcycling projects, lots of different ways that we can get the information in front of our students and really get them to engage with the issue.
You said NOAA, that is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration?
Yep.
And they're part of this Wisconsin Sea Grant, I believe, along with the university system and, of course, your program at Mount Mary University in Milwaukee. 2 years of this program so far, and what's the reaction been like from your students, Jessica?
They have gotten really excited about it, and I think it's really changed the way they sort of approach design. It's hard for students now because fabric is just in general getting more expensive. And when you're making a lot of things for school, it's quite the investment for our students. So they don't necessarily gravitate towards some of those higher quality natural fibers just from a cost aspect. But by being able to provide them with fabrics that they can just use, it really opened their eyes to the benefits of working with natural fibers. We actually just had presentations from our seniors yesterday about their upcoming senior collections that'll be in the fashion show next semester. And several of them in their work were saying, you know, after exploring this, I really want to use all natural fibers if I can. I really want to focus on using sustainable textiles. So they're really thinking about how they can implement that in their own design work.
And what have you learned? What surprises you about this program or was kind of news to you?
It was. I knew that fashion has not been the best ecological partner with the world.
But that's a long list of things, though, so it's not like fashion's alone.
But it's a long list of things. So I hadn't specifically thought about really the issue of microplastics. And like, once you start really looking into it and sort of like seeing some of the data, it's really eye-opening, and it's been really interesting. The best part of this is always interacting with the students and like the questions that they ask and how they always just have sort of a different spin on it than we do, and seeing sort of what lands with them, what they respond to. It's been really interesting for me.
So what then, and as you work with the Milwaukee River Keepers and Plastic Free MKE through this Wisconsin Sea Grant program now in its second year, what are the issues with microplastics? If somebody says, so what about nylon or spandex or other plastics in our fashion? Why should it matter to me?
Sure. So I think the issue is that something like 40% of these microplastics aren't filtered out when they go through a water treatment plant just because we're not equipped for it. So it's in our waterways, it's in fish eat it, and then we eat the fish. And I think the The one statistic that always stops everybody in their track is that it's estimated we each consume a credit card's worth of plastic a week.
Wait, I have heard credit cards worth of plastic a month. I've heard a credit card plastic worth of plastic a year. I've heard the same thing. I've heard it in different ways. But I also, you know, when it comes to that, I think whether it's a week, a month, or a year, I don't want to eat no credit card.
Correct. I also do not want to eat my credit cards. That is very true. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, I mean, you'd want to keep that out of your body. But what do the scientists say when it comes to ingesting these plastic? Well, what's the harm in a little bit of plastic in your diet?
Well, see, that's part of the problem is that this is sort of a newer area of focus. Mm-hmm. So we don't really have long-term data on the effects at this point. But it's not good. You know, like it's all plastic that's made out of petroleum. It's not natural. It's not edible. So I know there's a lot of kind of in-process research on what the actual effects on people are. And I make clothes. I'm not a scientist.
Right.
So I don't know. I wouldn't want to necessarily speak to like the specific issues that they're finding, but I know there is a lot of research in that area.
Jessica Frantel is our guest. She is an assistant professor in the fashion department at Mount Mary University, taking part in a program now in its second year through the Wisconsin Sea Grant, taking a look at sustainable fashion and what we can do to remove microplastics out of our waterways, out of our system, and how that can, to some degree, come from the clothing choices that we make. And you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to talk@wpr.org. So, Jessica, if I wanted to be more sustainable in my clothing purchases, if I wanted to avoid falling for greenwashing, what should I be looking out for? What should I do? Does it go beyond reading the label?
Yeah, it does. I think part of the problem is that in the era of online shopping, sometimes the labeling is misleading. I talked to my textile class last semester, and there are a lot of like bed sheets on Amazon that are listed as 100% organic Pima cotton. And then when you look down in the fine print, it's actually microfiber, which is a synthetic. Right, you have to really kind of do some due diligence. Choosing vendors who have a stronger ethos about sustainability. Choosing smaller vendors, if at all possible, local vendors. And I mean, there's no easy solution, right? At this point, everything is Walmart and Amazon, and it's closed down so many smaller retailers that it's really difficult to navigate, especially with costs going up and everything.
But
it's just finding ways to educate yourself and be sort of an educated consumer is really the best approach.
But this is where the light bulb goes off for me, Jessica, that there are no easy solutions as a consumer, but their solutions could be presented from the fashion industry. And here you are making the next generation of fashion designers, clothing distributors, folks who will get into the fashion industry, who have, as you tell me, in 2 years of this program, already changed their view on what they should be doing when they take their turn to become professional after their education and where they go and how they use this education to provide. And I always think of it in terms of like, I'm sitting here throwing out one plastic bottle at a time, wondering when, you know, the industry will change our bottling so I don't have to worry about whether or not that plastic's going to get recycled or somehow ends up back in the environment and somehow ends up in my system. You know, the consumer solutions, although admirable, seem to pale in comparison to the opportunity that industry itself would have.
Absolutely. And I think it's one of the struggles of sort of the sustainability movement in general is the companies really like to put the onus of that on us, right? Like they like to make it this sort of
moral purity issue of if you're recycling correctly and if you're not using reusable bags or plastic straws or things like that. And those are all really good things to do if you're in a position to do them, like, and not to negate the benefit of that. But when we look at sort of the environmental issues, especially of waste and plastics and things like that as a whole, it's the individuals affecting such a small amount that it's really important to try to make inroads into these larger systemic issues that are generating the most of the waste.
So I used to be in plastic extrusion. I would make toothpaste tubes for a living. And there were some days when there was so much waste that I thought to myself, I couldn't use this much plastic in a year. And here it is, right? sitting on the factory floor, just ready to be thrown away. And it was disgusting to me. But at the same time, it was part of the process of plastic extrusion. It's part of the industry. Yeah. And so, you know, and especially from younger kids, and I see them trying to change the world on their own. And, you know, it's like you say, it's admirable, but at the same time, it goes up against the magnitude and scope of industry, which is downright daunting. But for the next generation who are going into the fashion industry, it strikes me as an opportunity, especially if the consumers are aware of this, as you mentioned, Jessica, as an investment, that these clothes will last longer. I think in terms of like concert t-shirts, I've got concert t-shirts from the 90s that were all cotton that will never die. And I've got concert t-shirts from like 5 years ago that are cotton poly blend that are already dead.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. And it's, again, it's hard. So it's, you know, we've really leaned into this fast fashion culture in the last 5-10 years, and this idea that clothing is disposable.
Yeah.
And that it's okay to buy something off Shein or Temu or Walmart that costs $5. And then if you only ever can wear it once, it's okay because it was only $5, right?
Yeah.
So it's really changing the mindset. And that's the kind of thing that unfortunately happens a little more slowly. But having the opportunity to educate the people who are going into the industry is a really good way to increase that awareness and sort of bring it out to that higher level where it can have some good effect.
Jessica Frantel, our guest, assistant professor in the Department of Fashion at Mount Mary University, part of this Wisconsin Sea Grant program, now in its second year, looking for sustainability when it comes to fashion, slower fashion. Let's go to your questions now, and we'll start with Suzanne and Madison. Suzanne, hi.
Hello. Hi, I'll try to make this clear. I've pondered and pondered how I can change what we do, which is, you know, the disease of consumption and how we become infected by the disease of sustainability. And individually, I get really buried by it. You know, I do not see progress. But it occurred to me that collectively we could create a system where, you know, we do not buy to excess, but we somehow transfer a systemic transfer of us individually as families, as communities, somehow or in an organized way with the help of AI, transfer our consumption by providing our excess money and ability to share to others in an effective way. That's what I think has to be done. And I think with AI now is the time, you know, you want to give your money away to somebody who's going to benefit from it. Well, there's a jillion programs where they do benefit from it. And
sure.
Who needs so much crap that you can't even move in your basement? And that, you know, you want to invest in more of these units where you store all your stuff and then you forget what's even in there and you pay them $500 a month to do it.
Stuff. Right. I think it makes me think of an old George Carlin bit. Suzanne, I get what you're saying, and we have not touched on this, but reuse seems to be part of this program for you, Jessica.
Absolutely. So one of the projects we've done with students for a couple of years now is our junior students, we challenge them to do an upcycled design. So the past couple of years, we've had them go to a stuff swap hosted by the grant team, which is basically where people can just bring in things they don't want anymore. And other people can take things that they like. Anything that's left, we donate to sort of like well-sourced local resources who take on recycled clothes, things like that. And then we give them the challenge of taking these existing garments or sheets or whatever they've grabbed and turning it into a new look. And that's a really good exercise for them. Yeah, so that's been really exciting. They always do some very cool stuff.
Yeah, I don't know if you need AI, Suzanne, because I know some of the women here at Wisconsin Public Radio have done a clothing swap where the stuff they don't want anymore, they just bring all together and everybody goes home with something that's new to them, and nothing's bought, nothing's built, nothing's new, and everything gets reused, and it's an opportunity for maybe a neighborhood, a family, or, you know, an entire community to get together, throw all their old stuff in a pile, and take some new stuff to them home. Sounds like a solution. Jessica, can you help describe the students' current projects, the themes, fabrics, images that your students are inspired by and working on?
Sure. That's kind of a big question, right? Everybody does different stuff. How about this? I'll talk to something that tied directly into the grants.
Yeah.
So last spring, they did a project that involved using entirely natural fiber products provided for by the grant. They were inspired by water and ocean and environmentalism themes. So they were challenged to put that into their designs. And they have the additional challenge that because we're buying these fabrics in bulk, they all come undyed. So they're all white. So I did a couple of workshops and taught my students how to dye fabric to achieve their different effects and how to get the colors that they wanted. And they really got to like get really involved from the ground up in their looks and had just some really incredible results from it.
Is there one specifically, and I don't want to single out any student, but one that sticks with you that you can paint a picture of for us that, you know, we could see?
Yeah, absolutely. So there was one student who did a really elegant strapless dress that was all hand dyed. And then she created out of fabric a bunch of basically appliques that gave the look of different like sea corals and kelp and things like that, and appliqued it all up the side of the dress. And then she also made a hat to go with it that had those same elements embellishing the hat. It was simply stunning. It was a really fantastic piece.
And I can see it. I can picture it. How long does this program get to go on? Is there an expiration date? Are you hoping that this can continue in perpetuity?
So this is the last year of the actual sort of funded portion of the grant, but I think a lot of it has really embedded itself in the Mount Mary community. I've already talked to the gals from Plastic Free MKE, Milwaukee Riverkeeper. We would like to continue doing the stuff swaps even after the grant has completed. We're in the phase right now where they are working on sort of crunching all of the data, and we're going to be submitting to talk about this at some conferences next year. So I think it really ties into the mission of Mount Mary and is something that we're going to keep kind of built in going forward.
Jessica, I hope you'll share the data with us as well. I'd like to welcome you back.
Absolutely.
And you know, what you shared with me today is some hope. And for that, I can't put a price tag on. So,
right? We love some hope.
Jessica Fratell is assistant professor in the fashion department at Mount Mary University. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you are listening to WPR News.
As the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reported last week, lawmakers on the state's budget committee voted unanimously to release $10 million to address forever chemicals in northeastern Wisconsin. How will they go about it is still an open question. These forever chemicals, otherwise known as PFAS or PFOS, that are acronyms that I am unable to pronounce. I am Lee Rayburn, but it gives us an opportunity to investigate these forever chemicals, where we're finding them, what they're doing to our environment, as well as us. And if you've got questions about PFAS or PFOS, then you can join our conversation with our next guest by calling 1-800-642-1234. If you have a story to share about how PFAS contamination has affected your life, you can also send us an email to talk@wpr.org. Joining us now is Tisha King Hayden. She's a professor of biology at UW La Crosse, also a member of the university's River Studies Center. And Professor King Hayden, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much. I do have to correct the pronunciation of my name, though. No, it's King Hayden.
King Hayden. I'm sorry about that. I apologize. Okay. It's written right out here for me, and I missed it. I'm glad we can talk about you first, because I do want to talk a little bit about how this is personal for you and how PFAS contamination has affected your life.
Yeah, so I grew up in La Crosse and moved back when I accepted the position at UW La Crosse, and we moved to French Island. And unbeknownst to me, even as a toxicologist and knowing that PFAS was an issue, I didn't even really think about the fact that we lived so close to an airport. And right during kind of the pandemic is when most of us, on the island learned that our water was contaminated with PFAS.
And that contamination came from, it was firefighting foam, is that correct?
That's the thought. That's always a difficult thing to distinctly point to as a toxicologist, but typically when you live in close proximity to an airport, that is the primary source of PFAS.
Do we know if that firefighting foam is still being used? Has that changed at all? Are there still forever chemicals found in it?
That's really interesting. I just flew for a trip and chatted with someone in the airport who is a firefighter there. And we were talking about that, and they have switched over.
Okay.
Most places are, removing these firefighting foams that contain PFAS and no longer using them and switching to a safer alternative.
And now turning to some of your research, because we'll start here, that some of your research includes comparing legacy PFAS to newer PFAS, that there are some old forever chemicals and there appear to be some newer ones as well. Can you explain the difference between the two and why we're seeing legacy and new?
Sure. Well, we started using, these compounds started being developed in the 1940s. And so they've been used for quite a while, and their use really expanded in the 1970s. And they're pretty amazing chemicals, to be honest. Their structure allows them to be very heat resistant and water resistant. And so they're used in so many different products now. So initially, we had a couple of PFASs, and I'm just going to use their acronyms because they're long chemical names.
Thank you. I didn't want to have to say them.
But the original ones were called PFOS and PFOA, and those were kind of some of the legacy compounds that were used in things like Scotchgard and firefighting foams in carpets and things like that. And then we started to learn that, they might not be very safe. And so several of them started to be phased out. And the people working with these chemicals and developing these chemicals would kind of tweak them a little bit. And so we now, it's really, every time I read a paper, it has a different number of the types of PFAS that we have. It's really hard to keep on top of. And some sources, say thousands, and some say there might be up to 7 million types of PFAS variants.
So somewhere between 1,000 and 7 million.
Yeah, somewhere around there. Typically, we think like 12,000-ish that are really manufactured and identified in our commercial like supply chains. And yeah. So
where are we most likely to find these PFAS today in our products?
In our products?
Yeah.
Well, anything that makes our lives super convenient. They're just widely used in, so anything, any of our clothing that is stain resistant, water resistant, that's because of PFAS. Our food, our takeout food containers and, you know, wrappers for our food, it's not like wax anymore. It is all, you know, PFAS, some sort of PFAS. There's PFAS in cosmetics, in personal care products. I mean, it's just, and I think that's one of the biggest challenges is that these chemicals provide such a great, they're just great for manufacturing. But then unfortunately, their stability means that they're difficult to break down. And we're now learning that even low concentrations can cause some adverse health effects.
Yeah. So your research, I think if a coal mine is our waterways, then what is the canary for your research, Professor?
I'm looking at early stages of fish development. And so we use fish embryos as a model organism. They're useful because they can't feel pain yet. And so we know that when we expose them to environmental contaminants, they won't feel pain from that. And it's also during a stage of development when all of the organ systems are forming. And so if that's a really easy time to be disrupted by environmental contaminants. And then, you know, they're small and less expensive. And thankfully, due to evolution, they're an accepted model for human health. So the knowledge that we gain from these studies, we can use that to predict impacts on humans. And then more of my interest is to predict impacts on wild fish population.
How long has this research been going on now for you?
The PFAS work specifically has only been a couple of years. I typically work with emerging contaminants of concern. So I've worked with a variety of different environmental contaminants.
Like dioxins, metals, nanomaterials, personal care products, pesticides.
Yep.
It's going down the list.
All of the things. That these emerging contaminants are, you know, really like what we are really worried about right now. And when we do this work as toxicologists, we often start with kind of higher concentrations to try to see, you know, worst case scenario impacts. But my goal is really to look at environmentally relevant concentrations.
So we're trying to find how low we can go while still having a negative impact or at least some effect on development?
Yes. And my hope, honestly, is to see that there aren't effects. Right. So
right.
It would be great if we, you know, test these chemicals at the concentrations that they're found in the environment and we don't see an effect.
That would be your hope. But what's your hypothesis?
The hypothesis is usually the opposite.
Oh,
so,
man.
Unfortunately, and in my lab, we are studying all sorts of different endpoints. Right now, we're focused on how exposure during early development to these, you know, we're working with four different PFAS right now, and how they impact the immune system, and they're kind of, we classify it as neurobehavior, so a little bit of their reflex activity, their ability to escape predation, to capture prey items, things like that, that would impact them in the wild. And then several side projects when the joy of working with undergraduates is they get excited about something else. And so we do a little side project, which is always fun.
So what are some of the side projects you're looking at with these PFAS?
So I have several students who are interested in being like PAs and going to medical school afterwards. So their ideas are a little bit focused more on human health. So we're looking at the cardiovascular system. So we can take videos of these embryos and look at their heart rates and how much blood they're pumping out and looking at heart health. That's one thing that we're looking at. And then I have some students who want to go on in the field of like nutrition. And so they often are looking at, you know, impacts on the structures of the jaw and whether or not they can capture food items and get enough food to eat. And that's the primary focus these days.
I want to ask you this, because you're largely working on these embryos or larvae of fish, but from, you know, what I know about these things is that they accumulate in us over time and in other animals over time. So while you're looking at these developmental stages of these fish, Professor King-Hyden, I wonder, you know, how will we learn about what the accumulation means? As you know, we were talking earlier about ingesting a credit card of plastic over a period of time, regardless of what that period of time is. You don't want to ingest a credit card of plastic. So how do we begin to investigate the accumulative effects of these PFAS?
There are several studies where they will measure PFAS, different types of PFAS in blood samples or other human samples, in fish and other wildlife. Like the DNR, for example, will be measuring PFAS concentrations in primarily the fish fillets, because that's the primary edible component for people. And then sometimes they'll look at kind of the whole body concentrations of those. So those things are being monitored. And I know for sure with the DNR has a great interactive website where you can look at PFAS in particular. And most of it, I think, is all water, like surface water concentrations in the area. So wherever you live in Wisconsin, you can click on that map and see what has been measured in your area.
Tisha King-Hyden is our guest, professor of biology at UW-La Crosse and a member of the university's River Studies Center, taking a look at these forever chemicals in fish embryos and their health effects and applying them to what that could mean for our own health as we ingest them, when we ingest them. If you have questions about these forever chemicals or the research that Professor King-Hyden is doing, you are welcome to join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Are you still on bottled water in French Island?
Yes, we are. It's going on 6 years now.
Is there any indication that there would be an opportunity to get back to municipal water or anything like well water?
Oh, yeah. Well, so all of us on the island, like most, I think 70% of Wisconsinites, have our own private wells that come from the groundwater, which we've identified as not being safe. And now that we are a village of French Island, we have a different group, but like the board has been working diligently to identify a safe source of water for us all so that we can get off of bottled water. So I'm aware that they have, you know, done some tests on wells and have been able to go deeper in the aquifer, and have safe water. And the general plan is to use that as a source to provide then what would be like municipal water for the village of French Island.
Daniel emailed us. He says he was once a student of yours at UW-La Crosse, and he has a question. Which animals have high levels of PFAS? Do filter feeders like mussels or bottom-feeding fish have higher levels than, say, trout or perch?
Oh, that's a great question. So in general, I haven't read too much about the relative concentrations in like the filter feeders. And what's been really interesting with this particular contaminant is it doesn't behave like any other. The chemistry of it makes it really unique. So these long carbon chains, they have heads on them that are water soluble, and then parts of them are lipid soluble. So we are seeing that they biomagnify. So species like fish, as you go up in the food chain do tend to have higher concentrations than organisms lower in the food chain. And they have been identified in other wildlife species like deer. They're just not monitored quite as much as fish are. And what's really interesting to me is that we don't necessarily see a feeding strategy correlation for biomagnification, if that makes sense. So we're not always seeing, so for example, in the area, bluegill often have higher concentrations of PFAS than some of the other species. So it tells us a little bit about, you know, how they're getting it, taking it up through their food and the water, but it's not as clear cut as some other contaminants have been.
And also drawing some similarities here with like mercury contamination, where it ascends the food chain. So do we know if PFAS are moving from prey to predators then, and then are increasing in concentration at the top of the food chain, where I'd like to think we probably find ourselves?
Yes, we are seeing that biomagnification.
So
similarly.
Let's go to Karen and Madison. I think she probably asked the same question I'm thinking here next. Karen, hi.
Actually, well, the reason I'm calling is I wondered, Bill Moyers had a show on years ago, and he was a very forward-thinking journalist, studied many issues very thoroughly, and he turned out to be right. And one of these was chemicals. And at the time, he said, there are thousands of chemicals the manufacturers are making, and they've tested 14. Has that number gone up? Is there any more regulation about so that we're not playing catch up with all of this crap and junk, as my grandma would say?
Yes, that is a frustration that I share. The process in our country is that for non-like pharmaceutical chemicals, we don't require a lot of testing. So there is some initial safety testing in the production of new chemicals, but we really rely on scientists like me and other toxicologists to identify the risks kind of afterwards. And you're right, there are thousands and thousands of chemicals out there. And about 21 are currently like federally regulated. And what that means is we have to monitor those chemicals and measure them. And then if they're identified above their level that they're deemed safe, then whatever the source is has to deal with that. So for example, if you find it in your municipal drinking water, a level of a contaminant is too high, then the water treatment facility, like they have to find a way to remove that chemical.
So describe some of the results that, and some of your findings so far in your research into these forever chemicals, PFAS and legacy and new. Professor King Hyden, what do we know about what it is doing to these fish larvae and embryos?
Yeah, it's been, I've been a little bit surprised, to be honest. So the concentrations that we're looking at are well below the concentrations that have been tested in previous research. And so we just finished our work with the two legacy PFAS. So that's, we studied PFOS and its replacement PFHXS. So those are two commonly detected in the area. They haven't been used in decades, but they're still in the environment. And we have found that they do cause some disruptions in the fish larvae's behavior. And there's some signs for some potential neurotoxicity, even at these really low concentrations. And really surprising to me has been the impact on the immune response. So we studied the innate immune response, which is not what we typically think of, like we typically think of our antibodies and getting vaccines. This is the innate immune response is kind of your generic first line of defense. And we are seeing that that is inhibited by exposure to very, very low concentrations of these to PFAS.
Well, that's a little bit unnerving.
Well, and, you know, when you're working with these really low concentrations, it's not as if we're seeing, like, all the fish die or, you know, that they are so impaired that they cannot function at all. But the thought is that these subtle impacts can kind of add together. So if you're thinking about wild fish embryos and larvae as they are developing, once they, you know, start, they hatch out of their little eggshell and they're swimming around, they have a lot of things they have to, you know, defend themselves against.
Yeah, they got to survive.
Right, yeah. So there's, you know, predators trying to eat them. There's lots of bacteria and viruses in the water. And so our thought is that these really subtle impacts could potentially, you know, impact the number of embryos that make it through kind of those earliest stages. We call that recruitment, which could then, you know, be aligned with some of the impacts we're seeing on our wild fish populations. We are seeing declines in them.
Sure.
And, you know, as the previous caller stated, we can't always, you know, say it's this one particular contaminant, right? Because the fish are exposed to mixtures, as are we, right, of various different contaminants. And so, but we do think that PFAS can have an impact. And currently we're seeing those impacts under the concentrations that we have regulations for.
Mm. Where does research take you from here?
Well, we just started working with two more PFAS. And the other fun thing that we've been doing is I typically work with kind of two, they're kind of like lab species. So we have the zebrafish and fathead minnow. So zebrafish are not native to Wisconsin, but they're a common organism that we use for human health and toxicology studies. And then fathead minnows, most, if anyone fishes, that's a wonderful bait fish, very prevalent within the area. And that's more of kind of an ecotoxicology species. And then we've been also working with the DNR and Fish and Wildlife. They've provided us with walleye embryos and sturgeon embryos. So we're trying to do a multi-species comparison because we are seeing that in our study so far with zebrafish and fathead minnows, that the fathead minnows do seem to be a little bit more sensitive to the PFAS we've been looking at. And we would predict that the walleye and sturgeon would also be similar, at least to fathead minnow. And going into this, we thought the sturgeon maybe would be the most sensitive, but we're actually seeing they're the most resistant in our preliminary findings, that the walleye is super sensitive. But walleye isn't too surprising, honestly, because they are just a sensitive fish in general. So we're trying to measure uptake and see like how that differs across different species of fish. Is there a difference in the amount that they take up in the environment? And does that make them more or less, you know, at risk for these chemicals? And trying to see if we can identify any species specific impacts.
So there's a lot of research that is still yet to be done, but the initial research suggests that even lower than the suggested levels of PFAS or allowable levels, we're still seeing some impact on fish larvae and embryos.
Yes. And so they could have a subtle impact on fish. I don't, like, again, you're not going to see a massive die-off of fish,
sure,
per se. I mean, the concentrations of any environment aren't something that causes, you know, very severe response in the fish, but we are seeing kind of these cumulative subtle effects that are probably impacting our wild fish population.
Do me a favor and keep us up to date on your research. Let us know what you're finding, and I promise next time I'll get your name right.
Okay, no problem.
Tisha King Hyden, professor of biology at UW La Crosse, also a member of the university's River Studies Center, taking a look at the forever chemicals that are found in our waterways and ultimately inside ourselves. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to WPR News.